this episode, I talk with the talented Ben Rock. He is a writer, producer, director, and also the production designer on the original Blair Witch Project. Ben's new project is an audio horror story called Catchers. That's an Audible exclusive. After you're done with this episode, make sure you check out my fellow horsemen of the podcast apocalypse. Everything Went Black podcast, Into the Necrosphere, the Necromaniacs podcast, Iblis Manifestations, Showstomper podcast, and also the Soul Knox podcast. Thanks so much and hope you enjoy. All right, Ben, thanks for being on the podcast.
Yeah, thank you for having me. Very excited.
How's your day been going so far?
I flew in from Hawaii last night and I woke up and it's a much longer story. My wife broke her leg in Hawaii and I realized we didn't have anything for our 4-year-old son who was still asleep to eat breakfast. So I had to scramble and run to the store. So that's some unnecessary personal information of my morning for you. But that's my day so far.
Yikes. Well, hopefully she gets better soon and stuff. And sorry for your crazy adventure there.
We'll remember it. That's for sure.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, my morning's been very uneventful, but catching up on the series Evil that's on Paramount. I don't know if you've watched that before.
I want to watch it. I haven't started it. There's so much awesome television to watch, and I haven't seen that one show.
I think there's more good television nowadays than there is movies. You know what I mean? Like the production value and stuff. Like, there's so much shit out there.
It really is. It's shocking sometimes.
When you do start Evil, though, I think you'll really dig it. Like, there's 3 seasons out right now, and it's got a really like a cool dark sense of humor to it and stuff. And it's, I don't know, it feels really fresh compared to a lot of things that's out right now. So.
Yeah, my wife and I are very focused on The Old Man on Hulu. If you haven't seen that, it's pretty amazing with Jeff Bridges and John Lithgow. It's just an unbelievably brilliant show.
Oh, dude, I'm on episode 3 of that one. I'm like 2 episodes behind. Did they already have their season finale?
No, I think that's next week. I think that they have the second to last episode up. And so while I was out of town, I didn't really get a chance to watch it. And then last night we got home. We're on Hawaii time, so I'm in LA, so I'm 3 hours earlier than you, and then Hawaii is again 3 hours earlier than where I am. So my body's all screwed up. So we got home at like midnight basically last night from Hawaii, but in my mind it was still 9 p.m. So I after we got my son to sleep, I watched episode 6. It's such a good show.
It is. It's super well written. It just seeing Jeff Bridges like, you know, be a badass is pretty cool. You know, old man kicking ass like that.
Yeah. Him and Lithgow, man, they're just both unbelievably brilliant actors to watch. They're just fun to watch, both of them.
It seems to me like FX is killing it on like original TV programming and stuff.
Yeah, didn't they do Pam and Tommy?
I believe so.
I know that I watched both of them on Hulu, and Pam and Tommy was pretty amazing. Yeah, there's just a surplus of great television. So, in short, I haven't gotten to Evil. I think that like I have a weird bias against stuff that's network television, just because all the premium channels are kicking so much ass at all the other stuff, you know, and can go further. But I like to remind myself. Hannibal was a network TV series, so you know.
Exactly, and that still blows my mind because Hannibal's like one of the best TV shows ever made, in my opinion.
I agree. I ate that up. I loved it.
Going back to Evil, it does have a similar feel and or similar look to how Hannibal looked. You know, like super bright, vibrant colors and stuff. It's not quite as poppy as Hannibal was, but it still has that feel. And it also was done by CBS and. Now that Paramount picked it up, they're kind of more, like I've noticed in the second, third season, it's more edgy. You know, they're kind of going more for almost an R-rated feel to it, which is cool. You know, a little bit more blood, a little bit more cussing, you know. But yeah. And the effects, for the most part, are practical with, like, the creature makeup and stuff, which I really love, so.
That's cool. Isn't Asif Manvi on that show, or was he, at one point?
Yeah, he is.
Yeah, I actually worked with Asif. On a play before, like a bazillion years ago, before he was on The Daily Show or any of that stuff. Really nice guy.
Yeah, he's cool in this too. Like, I like his character a lot. So, how did you get started in the film world?
Oh boy, big question. Well, it was what I wanted to do. I mean, it was my, you know, like from a very early age, I wanted to be in film and specifically horror movies. Sorry, I sound like Jeff Bridges on The Old Man, but it's just because I'm kind of jet lagged.
No worries, man.
I mean, like even when I was a little kid, I grew up in Orlando, Florida, and we used to get on our cable provider, we got the Tampa station that had a creature feature with Dr. Paul Bearer. And it was like one of those old, you know, horror host kind of things where they show, you know, like old Edgar Allan Poe movies and William Castle movies and stuff like that. Like, you know, The Tingler, The Fly, that kind of stuff, Roger Corman kind of stuff sometimes. And I was way into that. And also my father, his best friend was a guy named Bob Goldberg, who unfortunately passed away about 2 years ago. And Bob Goldberg was sort of a hobbyist filmmaker. His day job actually was doing sound work for like radio stations and, you know, recording and stuff like that. He had his own recording studio, so he was able to do like voiceover work and stuff like that. And but he was a kind of an amateur filmmaker and was into stop motion and stuff like that. And I remember I saw the movie Clash of the Titans, the Ray Harryhausen one, and was blown away. And he was into stop motion, Bob was. Mm-hmm. And he would just do it with Super 8 and stuff like that. And he kind of talked me through how to do it. And I had a split 8mm camera. I didn't really know what I was doing. And I don't have any of my very, very rough experiments that I messed around with back at the time. But, you know, it was more just kind of like, you know, kind of falling in love with the craft. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that's when I was like a little kid. And when I was about 12, the same man, Bob Goldberg, got me Dick Smith's Do-It-Yourself Monster Makeup Handbook.
Nice.
I probably had told him at some point that I was into makeup effects, or I was interested at least in it. And so that kind of set me down a road. And, you know, I was like 12, 13 years old, and I stuck with it all the way through high school. And when I was in high school, I was kind of dicking around with trying to do prosthetics. I, again, didn't know what I was doing at all. But I went to a local community theater when I was about 17 years old, and they were doing a production of Frankenstein. And I just kind of walked in backstage, and I had made a Frankenstein prosthetic with, you know, plaster of Paris and liquid latex. And I showed it to the woman who was doing makeup on the show. Her name was Amanda Llewellyn. And Amanda was just, she was a little, you know, she was like in her like early 30s, and she was just kind of taken with, you know, my weird moxie and whatever, you know, that I walked in, and she kind of took me under her wing and trained me to be sort of her makeup assistant for several years. And I had been working in theater that whole time too. I was active in the theater at my high school, and then, you know, community theater when I got out of high school. But I always wanted to work on film, and in fact, went to film school in Orlando as well. I went to, there were two programs I went to there. One was at Valencia College, which is still there to this day. Actually, they're both still there to this day. And the other one was at UCF, mm-hmm. University of Central Florida. But while I was there, the first summer I was at UCF, in fact, she brought me to Mobile, Alabama to be her makeup assistant on a movie called Raw Justice, directed by David Pryor, mm-hmm. that starred a then unknown or relatively unknown Pamela Anderson. I guess she was known by Playboy fans. I don't think she'd been in, she might have been the Tool Time Girl. I don't think she was on Baywatch yet.
Right.
Her, Robert Hayes from Airplane, David Keith from a variety of stuff, Stacey Keach, you know, like all these kind of cool actors. Charles Napier. I was very starstruck to work with Charles Napier, actually. And I was the assistant makeup artist on this, you know, 35mm film.
Wow.
You know, shot on 35, lots of action, lots of stunts and cars blowing up and stuff like that. David Pryor made, I want to say, like 30 something movies in Mobile, Alabama, mostly Mobile and New Orleans, but he was based in Mobile. And I ended up working on like 6 or 7 of his movies. And that was kind of my introduction, at the time I wanted to be a makeup artist. Well, I shouldn't say that. At the time I was a makeup artist and I wanted to be a director, but I thought I couldn't be a director. And then enough years have passed. I feel like I can speak ill of someone who doesn't really work anymore anyway. Mm-hmm. Amanda brought me to Thailand to work on Bloodsport 2, which I was also very excited about because I'm a big genre fan. I was excited to work on it. Mm-hmm. The director on that was a guy named Alan Marez. And that one had Daniel Bernhardt, who's gone on to do he was the lead in that. He's mm-hmm. gone on to do just some amazing, amazing stuff. Like he's not like the marquee star, but like you see him pop up in a lot of Keanu Reeves movies where, like in John Wick and stuff like that. Yeah. He was in Suicide Blonde. He had, I think, one of the best fight scenes in Suicide Blonde. And Daniel's a sweetheart, but he's also one of the best fighters I've ever seen. And the director on Bloodsport 2 is a guy named Alan Marez. And I remember watching Alan not direct that movie. Like, he's the director, and I think he thought his job was to call action and cut. I think he must have had family money that got the rights to Bloodsport or something. I have no idea how he got to direct that movie. At one point, Pat Morita dressed him down in front of the whole crew, which was weird, because he didn't block the actors. And, I at the time thought that there was some dark art to how to do all this stuff. And, having done it now for a long time, it's like, it's not actually hard to block actors. It's not hard to block a scene. And if you don't have a strong idea, or it's not a scene that's like a specifically visual scene, like let's say it's a dialogue scene where one guy walks in the room and sits down and talks to the other one, all you really have to do is walk it through with the actors once and they'll figure 99% of it out if you don't want to. Right. And Alan didn't do that. And it was on that set in like 1995, where I was like, if this Jamoke can wake up in the morning and call himself a director, I can do it. And little did I know. But David Pryor was a different circumstance, because that guy just knew how to make a movie, how to make it fast, how to make it cheap, how to give it a lot of production value. He also knew how to cast. So he would get actors, as he once said to me, either on the way up or on the way down, so he would get people like Pamela Anderson, who was about to be a major star. Mm-hmm. How did he know that? I don't know. Maybe he had good casting people. And his sets were very fun to work on. You got paid, in part in fun instead of money. You got to do like stuff that he was always trying to do, stuff that huge budget movies would do all the time. He was always trying to figure out how to do it on a budget. And he was generally really smart about it. And he was a funny guy. And, it was a kind of film school to kind of get to work on a bunch of his movies. And then I worked on stuff like that, Bloodsport 2, where I worked on I was the only makeup artist on a movie. It was, I think, Catherine Keener's first leading role. Mm-hmm. A movie that was released as Heroine of Hell, which makes it sound like a horror movie, but it is not. It's an art film. Mm-hmm. And it was directed by the late great Nietzsche Gakin, who she did The Juniper Tree with Bjork right before that. So I don't feel like Heroine of Hell turned out to be a great film, but it was a good experience. But around 1997, I just realized I didn't want to do makeup anymore. And a very, very old friend of mine, I was talking to her about it. And I was like, man, I'm like 27 years old. I'm thinking all the time that I wasted. And she's like, well, imagine if you did it for your whole career and then, decided you didn't like it. Like, how much worse would that be? Right. So around 1997-ish, I kind of hung up my makeup brushes and sponges and pursued directing. That is a really long answer to your question, by the way. Sorry about that.
Oh, it's a killer answer though. Like, especially one of your first jobs working with like Pam Anderson and stuff, that had to be really cool. No. Did you have any did you get to talk to her, like, hang out with her, like any stuff?
A little bit. I mean, here's the thing. I didn't know who she was. Right. I just thought she was this, extremely pretty, very nice, off camera kind of soft spoken person. A couple of times she would have lunch with the makeup department, which was just me and Amanda. I should say Amanda and me, I was the assistant. I didn't do her makeup. I had to put some blood effects on her a couple of times. She was always super nice. It was interesting watching Pam and Tommy because I've never seen a movie, a fictionalized or a docudrama movie about someone I'd actually worked with. And, you know, I mean, I guarantee you Pamela would not remember me at all. But she was totally cool. You know, most of them are cool. Robert Hayes was super cool. You know, Stacy Keach kind of came and left really quickly. He was only there for like a day, so he didn't really socialize with us very much. Pamela was there for the whole shoot. And, or, you know, a giant part of it. She's one of the three leads. Mm-hmm. And, yeah, I mean, you know, it was my first real movie, you know, my first real, and, you know, you could argue it wasn't exactly a real movie. It was made for the straight to VHS market in the early 90s. But, you know, as far as I was concerned, it was a real movie and it had a full crew and, you know, they put us up in a hotel and it was, you know, it was honestly one of the most exciting things that ever happened to me. And like, you know, it paid horribly. I remember I was supposed to get paid $375 a week. Which is bad money in 1993 too, by the way.
Right.
And the day before I left, I got a call from the line producer, Jill Silverthorne. And she was like, "Hey, we can only give you $325 a week." And I was like, "Great. See you there." I was still in college. I was so excited to be working on a movie. But yeah, Pamela was cool. You know, I still know several of the people who I met on that set. Like they're, you know, it was a pretty awesome experience. I wish I had dirt. I don't really have any dirt.
I think that film there would make a good Joe Bob episode. I know Joe Bob's doing mostly the horror stuff now with you know, yeah. The Last Drive-In, but like, you know, I would love to hear Joe Bob's thought on this film.
he did David Pryor's first movie, Sledgehammer, on there, and it was interesting to hear him talk about David. David passed away in I want to say it was 2015. He was kind of young to have passed away as well. You know, but I'm still friends with his brother, Ted. And Ted was the lead. He was either the lead or the first AD in most of David's movies. And also he was one of the producers and he was the lead in probably David's best known cult movie, which is called Deadly Prey, which unfortunately I did not work on. I would have loved to have worked on that, but yeah, I think I was in high school or middle school when they made that. But David is definitely on Joe Bob's radar for sure.
That's killer, man. I've been taking a deep dive in a whole bunch of like direct to video 90s stuff, you know, just reliving my childhood, I guess. Like there's so much shit out there you thought you already watched, but like you go hunting for stuff like I've never seen this. So,
if you ever see Bloodsport 2, as I'm running down the director, I should prop up the two people who I think are responsible for that movie being pretty watchable, which are Jacques Heitken, the cinematographer, and Philip Tan, the fight choreographer. And Philip is a fucking legend. Mm-hmm. I mean, honestly, in his own way, so is Jacques. You know, like Philip worked with Spielberg and stuff like that. Like he'd done a lot of big stuff and he choreographed some just outrageous fights. I mean, part of the fun of that movie, of making that movie was watching those fighters do those fights. They were just intricately choreographed. And Daniel, who was, I don't know, he was probably still in his late 20s at the time. Like, you know, just honestly, he's still just as good as he was then. Today, but it was just like watching a great artist do that work. And then Jacques, the cinematographer, like they'd be like, "Hey, we need to do a dining room scene, but we don't have a restaurant. We lost the restaurant." So he's like, "Okay, well, we're all staying at this hotel." This is in Thailand, by the way.
Right.
I don't know if I missed that detail, but we're all in fucking Thailand. And he got the ballroom from the hotel that we were all staying in, and with a little bit of art direction and some really clever cinematography, makes a restaurant out of it. And, you know, I feel like Jacques probably really deserved directing credit on that. And Jacques, it should be noted, shot a bunch of Wes Craven movies, including the original Nightmare on Elm Street, which I kept talking to him about. I think I was annoying to him. But I was so excited to be working with a guy who shot Nightmare on Elm Street. Holy crap.
Yeah, that's badass. I'd be annoying the shit out of him too, you know.
It's what you do when you when you're like, oh, you made one of my all time favorite movies. Let me ask you questions. And I think Jacques, like, he wanted to be doing like prestige movies. He wanted to be doing like Oscar caliber movies. And he was annoyed that he was best known for genre. And I don't know, in the genre world, you find a mix of that. Some people wish that they were out of genre and some people don't. And Jacques told me at the time too, that Wes Craven wasn't crazy about horror movies. And then he wanted to do prestige movies. Around that time he did, or maybe a little bit after that, he did Music from the Heart with Meryl Streep. But I remember watching Scream, which is, you know, a classic. And like knowing that about Wes Craven, or at least knowing it secondhand from Jacques, I kind of felt like, oh, this is kind of Wes Craven's criticism of the horror genre. If you look at it as someone who doesn't want to be making horror movies, this is his way of saying this is everything that's wrong with horror.
Yeah, I can totally see that. Yeah.
Yeah. And in so doing, that kind of reinventing it, you know, I mean, it's just what the man was built for. He was so good at it.
Yeah. Hey, man, he was one of the best ever, you know.
Agreed. Agreed 100%.
Yeah, it was a sad day when he died. Like, but you know, unfortunately, the older we get, the more, you know, the folks we look up to are going to like pass on, and it sucks so bad, you know. Like,
I know.
I think about it all the time, especially with Stephen King, because I've been on a big Stephen King bender for like 10 years now, trying to get all his audiobooks and read all his books, like all of them. But he's still making new books as we, you know, as we speak.
I know.
I'm just like, man.
Two books since this conversation started.
He probably has. Like, he's a fucking machine, man. I'm like, I don't know. It's just thinking about that, like, makes me so sad. I'm like, man, losing Stephen King. I know that day is going to come. I'm going to see it on my Facebook feed, probably out of all places. I'm like, what the fuck, man, you know?
Yeah. Clive Barker, too. Clive Barker. Oh. I saw a screening years ago of the director's cut of Nightbreed that he was there for, and he was, I mean, he's still alive, so maybe he's not doing well at that time, but he seemed like he was not in great health.
No, from what I've heard, like a couple years ago, more than a couple years ago now, he had an incident at a dentist. It was getting some teeth work done, and something happened. He went into septic shock, and then from there, like, it went into something else. And if I'm not mistaken, he was in a coma for a little bit, and he hasn't been the same since. But he was on a Mick Garris postmortem podcast. What was it, this year? I think it was earlier this year.
Oh,
and he's
really
doing a lot better. Yeah, he's doing interviews again for the most part, you know, here and there. And I've heard he's been making some appearances here and there. So,
I know he did an appearance. A friend of mine went and saw him speak at Outfest last week. So,
oh, nice. He's one of my favorite authors, man. Like, Clive Barker and Stephen King are untouchable.
Agreed.
Also, I think Barker and Mick Garris are working on something top secret, but I don't know when that's coming out. But I'm thinking pretty soon, or sooner than later, because they've been talking about that since last year. So looking forward to that. I mean, freaking Mick Garris and Clive Barker, that doesn't get any better, you know.
That's pretty sweet. Yeah, I do listen to his podcast, but I missed that one. I need to go back and find it.
It's one of the best podcast episodes I've ever listened to. Like, I already look up to Mick Garris, and just hearing him with Clive Barker and stuff, it was a heavy one. It was so good. I was listening to it at work, and like, holy shit, that's going to be a hard one to top for anybody.
Yeah.
So tell me about being a production designer on the Blair Witch Project, man. That's fucking killer.
Well, yeah, I mean, that it's all nuts. So around the time I decided to quit being a makeup artist, my friend from both film schools I went to, Greg Hale, he was living literally about a block away from me in downtown Orlando. He had come out to L.A. and made what seemed to me like an unspendable pile of money working in the art department on the first season of Mad TV. And then he came back to Orlando where I was, and I was hanging out at his house, and he asked me, I've told this story a million times, so I apologize. he said, "Have you ever heard of the Blair Witch?" And I said, "Do you mean the Bell Witch?" Greg knew that I was kind of a nerd for this kind of stuff, like folklore and paranormal stuff and whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Excuse me. And he's like, no, the Blair Witch. And then he proceeded to tell me like a very, very rough version of the mythology. And then he said, "Hey, you know, Ed Sanchez from UCF, he has some friends in Maryland who went to make a documentary about it." And I was like, "What? Oh, that's cool." And he was like, "Yeah, but here's the thing. They disappeared." I'm like, "What the fuck? No." And he said, but their footage all turned up. I was like, what is on the footage? He's like, well, we're about to investigate that. And Dan Myrick and me are, you know, we're going to look through it. I was like, you guys are all going to die. And then he kind of, you know, broke character and told me, you know, like told me the whole premise of what they were going to do. And I loved it. Like, I just thought everything about it sounded like fun. The Blair Witch legend, which was not, yeah, I mean, it was there, but it wasn't fully fleshed out yet. And the way they wanted to make the movie, where it was going to be mostly improv and all that stuff, like everything about it just sounded like the most fun to me. And I think, you know, Greg had worked on Mad TV and he'd worked on some other big shows. We'd all been out of film school for a few years, you know, like I graduated, I think Greg and I both graduated in 95, but like December of 95. So practically 96, but I'd been working on those David Pryor movies and Bloodsport and Heroine of Hell and doing makeup, and Greg had been working on his stuff. He was mostly in the art department. I think he might've been in the union for art department. Mm-hmm. And, Ed had been living up in Maryland where he's from. And I don't know what he had been doing. And Dan had been kind of freelance DPing and editing, and he had a production company. And we'd all been kind of kicking around. Mike Manello, who was one of the co-producers, had been the marketing director at the Enzian Theater, which was an art house theater in Orlando. And had been doing marketing and going to Sundance every year, and kind of had his finger on the pulse of what was going on in the indie world, and had connections to a lot of people, which comes in handy when it came time to actually make the movie. So I basically said to Greg, like, I will sweep the floors. I just want to work on this. Mm-hmm. Like, it just sounded like a way to make a movie that didn't feel like a grind. It felt fresh and interesting. And so the first thing he had me do was kind of take that rough mythology that he'd laid out for me and refine it and add to it and kind of build it out into, today you would call it like a sizzle reel. Mm-hmm. I never heard the word sizzle reel until, you know, maybe 10 years ago, maybe more, but, it's certainly not in 1997. And so, you know, I literally went to the library because there was no internet, and you know, got pictures and scanned photos and did research and kind of wrote out, you know, named all the characters in the mythology, you know, kind of fleshed it all way out, like made it much bigger than it was and more specific, and wrote, I would say today I overwrote this pitch tape that they took the images that I had gathered and they brought in someone to do voiceover, and they made this tape that was sort of the more elaborate, slicker version of what Greg had said to me at his house.
Mm-hmm.
And they were showing it around town, trying to get interest, trying to raise some money. And then at the Florida Film Festival, which is at the Enzian Theater, John Pearson, who was a huge star, especially in 90s in indie cinema, he discovered, like, he wrote a book called Spike Mike, Slackers and Dyke. Slackers and Dykes. He sort of discovered Michael Moore and Richard Linkletter and Kevin Smith and all these people. And he was a producer's rep at the time. Mm-hmm. And he had a show on, I think it was IFC, it might've been Bravo, called Split Screen, which was all about indie filmmaking. And he was going to do a piece at the Florida Film Festival. And Mike Manello, who is the marketing director, very cannily maneuvered Dan Myrick to be his cameraman for that week. Mm-hmm. So John Pearson comes out, Dan's his cameraman, they're hanging out, they get to know each other. And at the end of the thing, Dan says, hey, I'm working on this movie. Can I give you this VHS tape and watch it and let me know what you think? And he says, sure, no problem. And then so he gives him the tape that we made. And like a week later, Pearson calls Dan up and he's like, you have this footage? What's on this footage? I need to know what's on this footage. And then Dan, you know, kind of told him what the whole thing was, and Pearson thought it was hilarious and actually commissioned two segments for Split Screen.
Mm-hmm.
So, and I believe the segment fee was $7,000. That was the budget. And so the first segment was that pitch tape plus some interviews with Ed, Dan, and Greg. And then we got the money ahead of time to make the second one. And between those two, we went and made the movie. So the budget, as I know it, was about 25 grand. 15-ish of that came from John Pearson. And so in between those, so they ran that segment, and then we went and made the movie, and then they made another segment after the movie was made, and they were actually able to show some of the footage. But very little, obviously. Mm-hmm. And his website, he had kind of a proto website for Split Screen, and it lit up, and it kept crashing because the traffic was too insane after they ran the Blair Witch stuff. Mm-hmm. And so he reached out to Mike Minello, who he knew from the Florida Film Festival, and said, "You guys, this is killing me. You guys need to set up a website so that I don't have to deal with this." And Minello, who was already into the internet and stuff like that, he's always 10 steps ahead of everybody. He convinced Ed, and he and Ed kind of put together the first, you know, the first website, the original website for Blair Witch at the time. I think mm-hmm. Ed did most of the, they had like some web builder app or something program that they had. I mean, again, this is like 1998 now. And so they put up that website, and that was how that piece of it came to be. Anyway, when we actually had the budget to make the movie, Greg asked me if I wanted to be the production designer, and I had been in the art department a bit. Greg was more of an art department person than I was, but they just needed another hand, really. They needed another filmmaker who could sort of be in the mix with them, who could focus on visual stuff, you know, like making the stick man and stuff like that.
Right. That's killer. And you're responsible for the actual stick man and stuff, right?
Yeah, yeah.
It's cool.
Yeah, there's video you can find of me showing it to Ed. And I have the first one, and it's just the same design that you've seen. It's no different. Mm-hmm. And I'm showing it to Ed, and Ed said, and there's video of this happening. And he's like, it looks like a pile of sticks tied together. And I was, you can see I'm kind of crestfallen. But Dan had designed this thing that was like a totem that would require like an assembly line of people to make. And I had like me and one other person in the woods with no power tools to make it. So I had to come up with something that we could do with mostly what we could find lying around, plus, you know, scissors, maybe a power drill, but like not, you know, nothing too complicated. And I have this book called, that I actually got for the movie. I still have the same book. It's called Magical Alphabets. Mm-hmm. And I was using it for the Transitus Fluvii, which is the lettering around the doors and windows in the house at the end. And people often think that there are runes in the movie, and there aren't. But the one thing that's kind of rune-ish is that there's a thing called the Rune Man, which is kind of a building feature. But if you look at the picture in the book of the Rune Man, and I can show it to you, you can sort of see the stick man in it. And I was driving down the street, and I had an epiphany, and I might still have this legal pad somewhere where I stopped. I pulled over, and I scribbled out kind of the proto Stickman, which again was not really any different than the one that was in the movie. Mm-hmm. And you know, when Ed kind of showed disdain for it, I did, you know, like a real production designer would have gone off and come back with like six other designs and said, which one do you like? Instead, I was just like, this is what we're doing, and forged ahead, and that's what we did. And I thought they all hated it until I saw it on the Sundance poster. When they put it on the Sundance poster, I was like, oh shit, you guys liked it. I really thought they hated it.
Well, and now it's like super iconic, you know, like it's a part of like horror history, you know?
Yeah, yeah. People like, I mean, like I'm on the, there's a group on Facebook for that's run by a guy named Matt Blasi. And Matt and lots of other people have it tattooed on them. And I'm like, oh, Jesus Christ, what have I done?
did y'all have any like weird kind of paranormal stuff go on like during filming and stuff? Anything strange happen?
I'm gonna go with no. I got lost in the woods once. That's not exactly paranormal, but it's scary if it's ever happened to you.
Oh yeah.
yeah, I got thoroughly lost in the woods once. No, I wouldn't say anything paranormal happened. I mean, it was like summer camp. You know, And I remember there was one night, if you watch the movie, you can see where it happens. There was one night where they got rained out. Like, it was just raining and raining and raining. And the three actors were like, fuck this. And they found a house and they called us from the house and the production put them up. And you can tell in the movie where it is, because one night it's raining and then the next day it's dry as a bone. Well, there was a day interval between those 2 days. And we had to go out, and they left all their gear in the middle of the woods. They left the film camera and the audio gear and everything, video camera, everything was just left in the woods. And we had to go to their campsite. And I remember I was so excited to be doing it. I was so excited to be like going out in the woods in the middle of the night and picking stuff up. And everyone else is like, what the fuck is your problem, man? Like, this sucks. Like, it's cold, it's rainy, and we're walking around and we're going to slip and die. But to me, it was like, again, it was like summer camp. I've never had that much fun making anything.
Really. Right. That's killer. Did you work on the Book of Shadows as well, the second film?
No, although I did get to go to their set, which was fucking weird. I went with Neil Fredericks, who also passed away. Neil was the cinematographer on Blair Witch. Mm-hmm. The closest I came was I was hired to make 2 TV specials. One for when the Blair Witch Project premiered on Showtime, and the other one for Sci-Fi Channel when Book of Shadows was coming out. So I had an original concept that I went out and I interviewed a bunch of their actors and crew, and I had a whole script written, and then artisan as stuff happened. I mean, this is not that unusual, but like without real explanation to me, just on a dime changed everything and said like, okay, never mind, we're not doing the special that you wrote and we paid you for, we're doing a different one now, here's mm-hmm. the idea. And they gave me an idea and I made it. It's called Shadow of the Blair Witch. You can find it on it's actually up on my Vimeo. This is all because I had written all the mythology and backstory, when the movie was getting ready to come out, they hired me to write Curse of the Blair Witch, which Ed and Dan directed. Mm-hmm. I was actually in LA. They were in Orlando and they made it all in Orlando. And Mike Minello produced that. And really, like, Mike Minello was the driving force behind getting that thing finished into the screen. And, you know, I feel like I keep bringing his name up just because I think Mike doesn't get enough credit. I feel like he would be a good interview for you. Like, he has such great insights into how it was. And he's the co-producer on the movie, but he was just like involved in every facet of it.
I would definitely like to talk to him in the future. It'd be cool.
I'm sure he'd be happy to talk to you. So my original concept was that there were paranormal events happening on the set of Blair Witch 2. Mm-hmm. Because I felt like with Blair Witch 2, you couldn't do what we did with Curse of the Blair Witch, which was to basically make the same pitch again. Here's the mythology. Here's the story of these 3 kids who went missing. You couldn't really do that with Blair Witch 2, since Blair Witch 2 is admitting that Blair Witch was a movie. Like, you know, like, it's baked into the premise of the movie. So I came up with this idea that I now understand why they weren't, why especially Joe Berlinger didn't want it to happen. But like, I kind of wanted to create a mythology around Blair Witch 2 that was its own, you know, like, I don't want to say a cursed movie like Poltergeist, but like, you know, creepy stuff was happening on set. And Joe, when I was there, when we interviewed him, he played right along. He was totally cool. Mm-hmm. Joe's never been anything but nice to me. And we interviewed all the leads, including Jeff Donovan. And I think we did not interview Erica Learson because she was shooting that day. We interviewed the DP, mm-hmm. Nancy Schreiber. And, you know, I was all excited to do that. And then, you know, they changed the fundamental concept. But I did get to go to their set, which was weird because, you know, when we were making it, our production vehicles consisted of Dan's Jeep. That was it.
Right.
And, you know, all the gear that we had would fit into Dan's Jeep or, you know, Greg's hatchback. And then there I am on the set of Blair Witch 2. And it's like, you know, it was a $20 million movie. So they, you know, they had like a small city of RVs out there. It was kind of nuts.
Yeah. I didn't realize the second film cost that much. I know it was that one came out like 1999 or maybe 2000, the Book of Shadows.
The first one, the original one came out in 99. Book of Shadows came out like a year and 3 months later. And I feel like that was, when I talk to people about its failure, and, you know, we could debate its artistic merits, but like, that movie was written between the months of like January and maybe early March. 2000, and it was in theaters in October. They were in such a huge hurry to make that movie. If they had, I feel like if they had done everything they did, and even Joe had made the same concept he made, but took, you know, 6 months to write the script and then allowed it to come out the following year, it would have been a different story. But it was written in such haste. And I feel like it just makes it, I'm not saying that movies can't be written in haste and still be good. I've heard the legend that, you know, Nightmare on Elm Street 3 was written over a weekend. I don't really believe it. I can believe that it was outlined over a weekend, or maybe like some parts of it were written. I don't know if there's enough time in 48 hours to write, you know, a 90-page script, but I just feel like, you know, the deck was kind of stacked against anyone who's stepping up to make a movie. And I'm sure that Joe Berlinger did what every director does when they're in a situation that makes no sense and sounds like total horse crap, is like, well, I'll make it work. I'll figure it out.
Right.
And you know, he had a great team around him. He had a lot going for him. I just feel like the script couldn't, it was almost impossible for the script to really be there. And I feel like Artisan was kind of cynically using his indie cred from making the Paradise Lost movies to try and angle for like, hey, look, this is an indie film. And it's like, no, it's not an indie film. You're making it like a studio film. But you know, I honestly can't complain too much, because I got to make two TV specials. It was the first thing I'd ever directed professionally, was the Burkittsville 7. And then Shadow of the Blair Witch, like almost immediately afterwards. And, you know, they were hard experiences for me just because of my inexperience. I'd been in LA for less than a year when that happened. But it was, you know, I look back very fondly on them both.
The coolest thing I remember about Book of Shadows is the special edition VHS that came out, where had all like the crazy like Easter eggs in there that you had to fast forward to or like pause at a certain time to see these certain things. I thought that was cool as shit.
The Secret of Estrevere, I think.
It was
all reverse stuff. Yeah, I mean, it's got a lot of cool ideas. And I think that was a marketing thing that was, I don't know if she came up with it, but the head of marketing at Artisan was a really smart, amazing woman named Emmerette Jones. And I think that was her brainchild, or you know, kind of came together. And it's really hard to make to gamify a movie that also has to work as a movie. And I think that on that level, that did work. I agree.
Yeah, that was like the coolest part of me. And I still have that VHS somewhere with a lot of dust on it, hiding somewhere. But I do have it.
I have a few of those myself.
Did you have anything to do with the 2016 release, the Adam Wingard one, or?
No, I mean, I rooted for it. I'm an Adam Wingard fan, but no, I wasn't. I wasn't consulted on it. I knew about it, but I was asked to keep it. I wasn't even NDA'd. I was just asked to not talk about it. I'm like, all right.
Hey.
So I didn't talk about it. I found out about it, actually, said something about it on social media before anyone asked me not to talk about it, and then one of the people from the original movie was like, hey, I had to sign an NDA, and if they see that you're talking about this, it might get me in trouble. Even though I didn't tell you, they might think I did. So could you delete that post? And I did. Although, even at that time, it was before it was revealed that The Woods was Blair Witch 3, I guess. If you went on, I want to say it was Bloody Disgusting. There was already an article about it. Like somebody had already figured it out. But, you know... I was rooting for it. I love Adam Wingard's work. I don't know him. I know Simon okay on Facebook. I don't think I've ever met him in person. But you know, you could not have grown a better director in a laboratory to make that movie than Adam Wingard.
Yeah, I think he did a killer job. I think it was a successful, like, you know, kind of almost like a readaptation of like the original almost. You know what I mean? That's what it kind of felt like to me. It definitely was a step away from Book of Shadows, you know?
Yeah, it kind of needed to be a reboot. You know, I mean, no one's asking me to make one, but if someone were to ask me to make one, I would say, like, ditch the found footage. Just don't make it a found footage movie. Like, you know, when... Before Joe Berlinger made Book of Shadows, we had talked about doing it. Like, you know, Ed and Dan and, you know, the whole Haxon team. I wasn't officially a part of Haxon, but I worked with them a lot. And the idea that Ed and Dan wanted to do was kind of a historical, like sort of the origin story of the witch legend, you know, like colonial era. Like I think they brought up Barry Lyndon, the Kubrick movie, as a visual reference. And at the time, I feel like the idea that horror could be artsy in any way was kind of anathema to the people in power, or at least the people who own the rights to that movie. Mm-hmm. But I feel like it's less like this now. But I have found in my travels that a lot of people think of horror as a debased genre that's made for demented 15-year-old boys who want to mm-hmm. look at boobs and see gore. And it's like, certainly that's there. You know, like, I'm not going to deny that I was a 15-year-old boy watching movies like that
right.
at one time in my life, but or that I still enjoy movie, you know, like I'll go back and watch a movie like Reanimator. I mean, I got to work with Stuart Gordon years later, so it has a special place in my heart, but I'll watch a movie like that. And I feel like the reason I watched it when I was 15 versus the reason I would watch it today are very different. And I see different shadings to the movie, but Stuart was someone who like knew how to satisfy that need of that industry, that perceived need of the industry, while also making something that I think was artistic and brilliant.
Oh yeah.
You know, but like, you know, much internet ink has been spilled over, you know, the Joe Berlinger director's cut of Blair Witch 2 and how they made him go back and shoot the gore and boob scenes. And it's like, yeah, they were going to make a tits and gore movie, even though the original Blair Witch has virtually no gore. It's got like one bloody prop mm-hmm. and obviously no tits, no nudity, no sex appeal. It's not a movie about sex.
No.
And I feel like Ed and Dan were onto something. And the only thing I could really compare it to is The Witch. Like I would flatter any of us to say that's the kind of movie they wanted to make. I think The Witch is brilliant.
Oh yeah, same here.
And that was the kind of movie they wanted to make, but they wanted to make it in 2000. And in 2000, the conventional wisdom of the industry was tits and gore, you know, feed it to those 15-year-old boys who will 100% of them grow up to be serial killers. That's like the, I feel like that was the vibe that I would always get. And I would get that. I don't get it as much now. Like I recently did some stuff for Shudder. Shudder's not like that. They get it. You know, when I've dealt with certain production companies and whatnot, they kind of don't understand why a grown up adult person would love horror. And I'm like, sorry. Like it's not just me, and honestly it's not for guys. They know this now. Like I feel like this is easy to come by knowledge that demographically horror skews more female than male, that horror fans do, and that, you know, they are older than we think they're, but you know, there was kind of a stereotype I think was put in place by, you know, by the 1980s for fans of, you know, specifically like Friday the 13th, Nightmare on Elm Street, Sorority House Massacre kind of movies. And I love those movies too. I'm not slagging those movies at all. I think they're all great. But I just feel like that perception forced Joe Berlinger to make a movie that was more exploitive than he wanted it to be, and also kind of prevented Ed and Dan from making the Blair Witch 2 that they would have made in 2000. Would it have been everything they wanted it to be? I who knows?
Right. Going back to the Shudder thing, you did a Video Palace, the podcast for them, correct?
Yeah.
That's killer. I love like fucking, you know, narrative podcasts, like, you know, crazy ass stories. That's really cool. And Shudder's really fucking cool.
No, they were great to work with. I mean, the only catch when we did it, but we knew it going in, was that they just needed it turned around very quickly. But it was an amazing experience. We got to work with it. That was Mike Minello again. That whole Video Palace was Mike, the brainchild of Mike Minello and Nick Brachia. And they had sold the idea to Shudder. They had gotten Shudder interested in selling in buying the idea, but they work full time doing marketing and advertising stuff at a company called Campfire in New York City, which is mm-hmm. Mike's company. Mike basically founded that company off of the strength of the Blair Witch marketing stuff that he masterminded. And so Mike reached out to me to see if I would be interested in writing and directing it. And I brought on Bob DeRosa, who I've been working with Bob for years. We've done a lot of like late night gross out goofball theater and stuff in LA. And we also had done a web series called 20 Seconds to Live together. But Bob had TV writing experience and I didn't. And I felt more comfortable working with someone who understood firstly my sensibilities as a director, but also somebody who understood, you know, how to break story in an episodic manner, because he'd done it many times. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, Bob and I kind of co-ran it, although I defer to Bob. He's a much more experienced writer than I am. And we broke it on, you know, literally old school on a cork board with index cards and broke the whole story all the way through. And it was a blast. And it just went so fast. It was just unbelievably fast, the whole thing. Like, we were brought on, my son was born in May of 2018. Mm-hmm. We started in early June. So I was a sleep deprived ghoul of a 3 week old son when I started. And so we started in early June. We turned in the final thing at the very beginning of September. So in that period of time, we wrote it, cast it, recorded it, and edited, posted, sound design, music composed, delivered, address notes, delivered. And it was one of the fastest turnarounds, but I got to work with just an amazing cast. I was so excited to work with Chase Williamson. I love Chase's work, and he's such a great guy to work with. And Devin Seidel, who I actually knew from theater. So she played Tamara. She's the other lead. And Larry Cedar, who plays Randy Wayne. Just a great cast.
That's killer. And that was, I think they released that during Halloween time, like October, I believe.
They did. And we didn't know that while we were making it, by the way. We knew that we were under a huge rush. But, you know, I've been in that circumstance where I'm making something and it's rush, 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 rush. And then you deliver it to the network, and then they sit on it for 9 months. You know, that's happened to me more than once. And I actually did a web series for the movie The Ruins, and it was like that: rush, 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 rush. And then, like, while we were making it, they delayed the movie's release by 6 months. So once we finished making this web series, they just like sat on it forever. I don't even know if you can find it anymore. So we didn't know while we were making it that they were going to put it out in October. We just knew that they wanted it in early September. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they had it for, you know, I don't know, 2 or 3 weeks before it started going out. It was crazy.
I remember seeing a lot of like stuff for it. Like, we're hearing a bunch of ads for it, like, you know, with all the different horror sites I go to and some of the other podcasts I was listening to at the time. Like, it did really well, you know.
Yeah, no, it was a really fulfilling experience, honestly, and it was a lot of fun. I had never done an audio project, although I've done a lot of audio editing, and I feel like I know how to think in audio. You know, I'm not a practiced old hat at it, but I know how to do it. And Mike Minello and I, for probably 2 or 3 years before that, were kicking around the idea of like, hey, let's just make horror fiction podcast. Let's make a thing. Let's just do it, because it doesn't need to cost that much. And this was sort of like the perfect storm for us, because we've been talking about it for so long, and I'm a podcast obsessive and have been since whenever it was the podcast first showed up on the iTunes store, which I think is like 2006. I started listening to podcasts, and like, you know, barely have listened to terrestrial or satellite radio since. Like, I'm just like podcast, you know, like I listen to too many podcasts. and I love them. And, you know, it's one of my favorite ways to get information. And I talked to Mike about like, what if we did a fictional one, and, you know, using techniques that we knew from the Blair Witch days. And we totally did that, by the way, like, on Curse of the Blair Witch. Instead of like writing, and this carried through Curse of the Blair Witch, Shadow of the Blair Witch, I did a TV special for FX for Hellboy, the first Hellboy when it came out. Oh, same cool. thing. Mm-hmm. When it's called the BPRD Declassified. Whenever we're interviewing someone, when someone is just an interview, that's the whole character. I write up a bio, and we use it for the auditions, and then we use it for the actual interview session. It's like a 2 or 3 page bio, and we basically say, elaborate on this. I'm going to interview you as you with this information. This is just the information for you to have. This is not a script.
Mm-hmm.
And Joel McCrary, who plays, Jacob Manders in Video Palace. He's worked with me on a bunch of things, and he's done this before. So he was, you know, he'd been in that world before. I create like, 2-3 page document. Here it is. And then, come in, tell me your name. Okay. So tell me about, tell me about the, when you worked at the Video Palace and, Kelly Holden Bashar, for instance, just unspools her story. And I encourage them to add their own details to it because it doesn't matter. Not only does it not matter, it's actually better if their details stray a little bit from the page. And when I'm writing the bios, if I'm writing two people who are in the same place, I sort of write their point of view or their opinion or what they saw differently intentionally. Mm-hmm. So that, because if you and I were, at a grocery store and we saw it get robbed, but I was in the produce section and you were in the meat section, we would have different stories.
Right.
So when you're dealing with something like in the case of Video Palace, where you're dealing with the eyeless man kind of manifests a little differently to everybody. So everyone who describes the eyeless man has a different description of him or a different story about him. And that's by design. And that was also something that we very, very much did with Blair Witch. And that was when I did the Burkittsville 7 and Shadow of the Blair Witch, I would give people opposing points of view about things. So you'd have one person saying in the Burkittsville 7, you'd have Janine Brody, Kyle Brody's sister, defending him against all the charges that everyone else is saying about him. Mm-hmm. And so in her bio, I probably have it somewhere still on a hard drive. But on her bio, it's like, you're tired of your brother being attacked and he's been dead a long time now. And it's not cool to do what people are doing. And anyone who attacks your brother is a monster. And then, to the other people, it's like, here are the two psychologists who worked with Kyle Brody in the asylum, and here's what they saw. And, in the case of Video Palace, whenever we have, we have the eyeless man, or we have, what it was like inside the Video Palace, even like people's memories are going to be different about it. I don't like sometimes people about Blair Witch will ask me like, well, is this canon or is that canon? And I'm like, it's folklore. What's canon in folklore? Like if I was to say, what's canon in Paul Bunyan? It's like, yeah, I could make up a new character that takes place in the Paul Bunyan extended universe. Nobody cares.
Mm-hmm.
Especially in like older folklore, stuff doesn't get like codified and solidified in place. And it's a little bit more realistic, in my opinion, if everybody sees it a little bit differently, or if they all heard a different story. Like in Video Palace, Adam Green, the filmmaker, is in the first episode, and his story about all of it is very different. He a lot of that stuff Adam made up, but I told him to do it. Like I was like, here's the basic brief. Feel free to riff off of it however you want. So, he hadn't heard them call the white tapes. He'd heard something else. He had a different name for him. And it's like, yeah, that's what would happen. That's what would happen if this thing was real and Adam was in, I guess, Massachusetts, and, it's a few states over from where it started. And, that's how the telephone game of folklore,
That's killer. And like I said, it was super successful. And do you see yourself doing any more like a narrative podcast like that? Story driven?
Well, Bob and I are, let me ask you real quick. How much do you edit this?
I edit whatever you need me to edit. I don't edit like heavily or nothing, unless there's some weird shit going on. So,
I'm asking because I can tell you, I can give you more information, and I haven't been specifically embargoed,
mm-hmm.
but I want to treat it like an embargo because Audible hasn't announced it yet.
Oh,
So I can tell you, or I can tell your podcast. And as soon as Audible announces it, you can release the podcast. If you want to release the podcast this week, I can't really talk about it.
Okay, I usually wait anyways on the podcast. So if you want to like go ahead and tell me now, and then I'll release it once you tell me that the embargo's out, off of it and stuff, then we can release it with that if you want. So
if you want to, yeah, that's cool.
Yeah.
Let's then I'll tell you. But again, like, just, you know, promise me that you're not gonna.
Oh yeah, definitely.
Release until, yeah. Because yeah, Audible. I don't know when Audible's gonna officially announce it. So Bob DeRosa and I, off of Video Pals, were hired off of Video Pals, Bob and I were asked to pitch some ideas to Audible, and we pitched several ideas, and they really liked one of them, and it's called Catchers. Mm-hmm. And it's supposed to be coming out this October. I believe October 27th is the date I was told, but you know, they haven't announced it yet, so who knows. Mm-hmm. It is not a first person investigation in the way that Video Palace was. It's more of a third person, like it's an audio drama, you know, with a full cast. So it stars Horizon Guardiola, who was on Netflix. She was on a show called Dare Me, and she was on The Get Down, I think it's called, the Baz Luhrmann show. She was one of the leads. She was the lead on Dare Me, which is about murderous cheerleaders. And it stars her and Billy Gardell, who's currently Bob on Bob Hart's Abishola on CBS, mm-hmm. As two small town dog catchers. It's basically her training day. She's there to replace him. And they're called out to a small farm to deal with some animals that were attacked. And it turns out that it wasn't coyotes or whatever, bobcats. It's a horrible monster that turns out to be horrible monsters. And, you know, they have to fight to save themselves and everyone around them throughout the night. And I'm really excited. The whole thing is we finished recording it several months ago. We're fine tuning the mixes now. The cast is great. Sounds really great. Steve Moore of Zombie did the score for us.
Oh, badass.
Yeah. I was very excited to get to work with Steve. He's great. And, I mean, it's a big step. I don't want to say step up because I don't want to. Video Palace was a huge step up for me because I'd never done audio. This is mm-hmm. just a very different way to explore the audio production, but it's also, you know, probably the way that's been done the most historically. So it's not like you can't find resources. And it was also something we did during the pandemic. I say like the pandemic's over, but at a time when we couldn't have multiple actors in the same room.
Right.
So that created its own, a lot of Zoom sessions.
That's killer, man. That's something to look forward to, man. I love audio dramas, you know, especially horrorcore. So that'd be really cool.
It'll be released on Audible, so it'll be on their platform. So I'll let you know, you know, feel free to stay in touch with me and ask about it. And then I can't really say more than this, but Bob and I are in talks to write another audio project right now. So, but it's so unofficial at this moment that I can't really say what it is.
Understandable. Another thing I want to talk to you about is I didn't realize till I was doing research that you did your first feature film was Alien Raiders.
Dude,
I loved that movie when I first saw it. It like came out of left field too. Like, you know, the special effects is what really got me with that one. Like, super gnarly and like, oh, this is cool as hell. So I thought that was cool.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, I have Dan Myrick, co-director of Blair Witch, to thank for that. He was the executive producer. He had formed a company out here in LA called Raw Feed with Tony Krantz and John Scheiben. And they made three movies in like 2005 or 2006. Mm-hmm. And for Warner Brothers. So it was for Warner Home Video. And then in 2007, Warner asked for another three. And Dan gave me my directorial feature debut with Alien Raiders back then. It was... That was an insane experience because all those movies had to be shot in 15 days. So every one of those Raw Feed movies was just made like outrageous. They almost did it like TV. So they had like one crew. The director got to bring on their cinematographer and their first AD, and those people got to bring on their teams. But like production design, wardrobe, props, all that stuff, production. Was all the same crew from movie to movie to movie, and they would do three of them in a row. And Alien Raiders was the last one they did, and it was also our last day of shooting was the day before Christmas Eve. So, like, we really, there was no way to go over one day. If we went over one day, the budget overage would have been insane because they would have had to hold that location over for the next year because no one's going to work the week of Christmas.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, everyone's out of town. So we had to finish, had to finish. But yeah, it was a crazy experience. Got to work again with some great actors, Joel McCrary, who's in Video Palace. He's in that. Bonita Friederike, who was in Video Palace and is also in Catchers.
Mm-hmm.
That's where I met her. She's in that. You know, a lot of my good friends and old contacts are in there. And also, you know, at the time, 24 was one of the coolest shows on TV, and Carlos Bernard was was Tony Almeida, and I could not have been more excited to work with Carlos. Like, I just loved working with Carlos. He was great. Matthew St. Patrick, who was on 6 Feet Under, he was great. Rockman Dunbar from Prison Break, he was awesome. Courtney Ford, who was on Dexter and True Blood, she was amazing. Like, we really had a great cast on that.
Yeah, I recommend anyone listening to that, well, listen to this episode here, to check out Alien Raiders, man. I think it's a cool hidden gem. I don't know where, I haven't seen it streaming anywhere for a while. Yeah, I think I rented it on DVD, so.
It was on, for a while, it was on Vudu. I don't know if it's still there. Like, you could stream it with commercials, I think, for free. I don't know if it's on Tubi. The funny thing is, I don't know what's up with all, so there are 6 raw feed titles. So it's like Sublime, Otis, Believers, Rest Stop 2, and Alien Raiders. I think that's all of them.
Mm-hmm.
And none of them are streaming anywhere. It was on Showtime. They were all on Showtime for a bit of time. But I don't pretend to know the legalities of that or why, you know. It's a small library, but it's a library, 6 features. Rest Stop and Rest Stop 2 were both pretty big hits, I think.
Yeah, they definitely were.
And I think Alien Raiders actually did decently for them. You know, like, the thing is, like, when we were making Alien Raiders, the economy tanked. Maybe a month or two before we started shooting was when Lehman Brothers crashed, and then we went into a humongous recession, right? And right around then also was, like, the rise of piracy, Pirate Bay, and, you know, BitTorrent and all that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, when you look at what the very same industry of kind of the lower budget genre stuff is today. Like, today you'll be streaming on Shudder. You might be streaming on Amazon Prime or Netflix or whatever. Like, you'll see movies, like, our budget was $2.25 million. You see movies of that budget level streaming on those platforms left and right. Physical media was about to die. And as it was made for physical media, and the entire business model for physical media was, in my opinion, or packaged media, I guess they call it, was a little goofy.
Right.
The business model was put movies nobody's ever heard of in Target and Walmart and charge $20 for them. And when the economy tanks, no one's going to spend $20 for a movie they'd never heard of. So, like, all the home video stuff died. And then, you know, this is not an uncommon story, but, like, my movie came out in America in January 2009, but it was released in Japan about a month earlier. And so I had the trailer on my, and it still is on my personal YouTube. And, like, I was super excited. I had like 5,000 views. Like, I was out there pushing, right? And then one day, apropos of nothing, it doubled. And I was like, what? What just happened? And what had happened was, it got released in Japan. Somebody ripped it, stuck it up on Pirate Bay or whatever, and they were referring to my YouTube page for the trailer. And it just kept doubling every day and every day. And I actually called the Warner Brothers people, and I'm like, this is happening. There's like, there's nothing we can do about it.
Mm-hmm.
Like, really? Nothing you can do about it. And, you know, there's a lot of filmmakers, I think, who got lost in that shuffle. Or, you know, certainly whose careers got dinged. I remember talking once to Dave Parker about this. And it's like, we both had Warner Brothers movies that came out the same year. And that was, as I recall, I don't mean to speak for Dave. I feel like his story was similar, if I recall correctly. But, you know, because he did The Hills Run Red, which is an awesome film.
Oh, yeah, and, totally.
But it came out, made by Warner, came out around the same time. So, like, we don't get to keep making these movies because we're handsome. We get to keep making these movies because they make money for somebody. And right. If you look at it now, like, the entire model has changed. Physical media is almost a niche thing that almost, you know, like, is not for a good, starting in the 80s, going through, you know, probably 2007, 2008, home video was huge business for a lot of these companies, and a lot of independent studios were able to stay. I'm sorry, I don't mean to get all businessy about it, but they were able to, you know, they were able to release more niche stuff because they would make their money back on home video. So a lot of times, you know, a movie would come out with a limited theatrical release. It was really, they knew they weren't going to make their money back theatrically, but they knew that they would, you know, quadruple their awareness when it came out on home video and make more sales there if they did a theatrical run. So the theatrical run was almost a marketing ploy for the video, the home video release. Mm-hmm. But now, you know, now it's all streaming. And although I'm sure there's a way to pirate a streaming thing, there's no reason to almost, you know, it's like, you know, like you're not going to pirate individual movies off of Amazon Prime, even if you're, yeah. I'm sure somebody's doing it. I've never been on any of those sites. I, with some shame, admit to being excited about Napster in the early Napster days, but I've never pirated a movie. And by the way, like when Napster came out, I'm like, if they would charge me, I would be happy to pay for the service of I pay money and I get all the music I want. And today I'm, you know, I do that. Which is, you know, not always great for the artists and creates, you know, for filmmakers creates a black box. You know, like if you have your movie on Netflix, you don't know how many people saw it. You don't, the residual structure and all that stuff, which is what we use to make a living in this business. You know, cause you don't get to work every day. You don't, it's not that every day is a fucking vacation. It's that you're hustling all the time and you're hoping that you get to work again. So, you know, when Netflix is kind of opaque about residuals, it just changes the way that you have to do your business. It changes how much you have to charge for your work. But, you know, I'm glad that echelon of movies has made a comeback, that there's a lot, it seems like there's a lot of those movies. And I feel like Shudder, Arrow Video, Shout Factory, like those places are very responsible, but Shudder's probably the one that is most responsible at the moment because they buy and release so many cool genre movies. And, you know, I think it's, you know, I'm not just saying this because I work for them, because I haven't worked for them for a few years, but like, you know, they're an amazing service. And probably when I turn on my TV, it's the first one I go to every time.
Oh yeah, definitely for me. I've been with Shudder since, you know, getting Shudder service since the beginning, and I've referred so many damn people to Shudder. And then another one too, like you said, Arrow Player is really damn good. I love Arrow. Arrow and Shudder are my favorites out of all the streaming channels.
Yeah, Arrow is like, you know, what I like about Arrow is like, it's not that Shudder is afraid to go weird, but Arrow goes real weird.
Yeah, and I love that, yeah.
Yeah. Like they gave Brian Lanano his own, like they had him curate a bunch of things. There was like the Brian Lanano collection, and Brian Lanano, like he made one of the funniest, darkest, and most disgusting short films I've ever seen, Gwilliam. Mm-hmm. And he's the nicest guy too, but it was like, whoa, Arrow Video gives Brian Lanano his own, like, yeah, I mean, good for both of them. It was just like, that's something Shudder would not do.
Right. Yeah. I mean, between those two, like you get your super weird with Arrow and then you get your, like, you know, other weird, but not too weird on Shudder. You get more kind of like a more of a mainstream feel, I guess, but not really mainstream, you know? But between those two, I mean, they're the kings of horror streaming.
Yeah, I wish like Vinegar Syndrome and Shout Factory would. I mean, Shout Factory has a channel, but it's not done like Shudder. But I wish that I could have Vinegar Syndrome would be amazing, just because like they are the pinnacle of weird.
Oh yeah, most definitely. I've seen some things from Vinegar Syndrome, so that would be cool. Maybe in the future they will do a streaming channel, because it seems like everybody's doing a streaming channel now. So.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's how they're going to make money. I mean, you know, I remember those days of like going into, you know, any bookstore, Best Buy or whatever, and they'd have an enormous movie section. And, you know, those days are over. And I don't know. I mean, like there's something to be said about having physical media. You know, there's something about, like, you know, I have the Shout Factory reissue of the thing where they rescanned it from the original negative.
Oh, nice.
And there's something about being able to, or Dead Ringers, I have the same one, where they rescanned it at the preferred aspect ratio of the cinematographer. and David Cronenberg. And, you know, there's something about having that, being able to throw it into a player whenever you want to see it. And kind of, you know, that moment of discovery when you're in a store and you find that piece of media, you know, be it a record or a book or a movie, and be like, oh, I love this movie. I can't wait to watch. I can't wait to go home and watch it and own it. And it's like part of my collection that I, it's part of my identity that I have it versus versus like, on Shudder, for instance, I was watching Poltergeist, 3 weeks ago. Mm-hmm. And it was late and I fell asleep and I wanted to, and I paused it and I was like, I'll come back to it tomorrow. Well, it wasn't tomorrow. It was maybe like 4 or 5 days later and it wasn't on the service anymore. And it's like, okay. I mean, I think I actually own a DVD on Poltergeist. So I'm just a lazy asshole who won't take it out of the package and put it in my, in my player. But, you know, that's the nature of the streaming stuff, especially like, you know, if it's a Netflix original, it's probably going to be on Netflix forever, but you don't know, like they could decide, you know, I don't think they took down House of Cards, but like they could have, you know, when the Kevin mm-hmm. Spacey scandal broke, they could have been like, fuck it, we're taking this all down.
Right.
They could have done that. And, you know, so you kind of never know when, you don't have control over whether or not the media is still going to be there for you when you want it. You know, like John Carpenter's Prince of Darkness, I think, is on Shudder now. Mm-hmm. It was on Shudder like 3-4 years ago, and it's one of my favorite John Carpenter movies. And I went to watch it one day, and it was gone. Why? Well, you know, like it probably costs a chunk of change to license that movie, so I don't know how much it costs. You know, it's from 1987, so I don't imagine that it's like crazy expensive, but also cost something and that's out of their budget, or, you know, who knows what their contract terms are and stuff like that. You don't have to deal with that if you own the piece of media, but, you know, I fear that, like, you know, in years to come, that will just be the most arcane idea. You'll just be, I mean, this is something we go into in Video Palace, right?
Right.
You're writing Video Palace. I watched, a documentary that I believe is all on YouTube, and the filmmaker put it all on YouTube. It was not pirated on YouTube, called, I want to say it's called Adjust Your Tracking. Mm-hmm. And one of the guys who's in Video Palace is Eric Spudik. And I know Eric, but I saw him in that documentary and I'm like, I got to bring him in. But it was all about VHS collector culture. And you kind of go, okay, what kind of person collects VHS? And then you realize, and this actually brings me right back to where we started, frankly, those movies that I worked on for David Pryor, most of them were only released on VHS. I think Raw Justice came, actually, I know Raw Justice came out on DVD because I own it on DVD. It will never be released on Blu-ray. No one's going to remaster. No one's going to remaster that. David's dead. It's never going to come back. But like, there are so many movies that were made, and it's like, we're made by the same fucking film crews that make anything else, made by these crews, you know, we work in long days, putting in their all. Some of those actors went on to be huge actors. Some of those directors, cinematographers, et cetera, went on to do bigger stuff. But their work only exists on VHS and will only ever exist on VHS, and VHS is going to degrade, you know, it's not going to last forever.
No.
So after some years, I don't know how long a VHS tape lasts for, but probably not more than, you know, I don't know, 30, 40 years at most. That work just won't exist anymore because nobody on earth is going to bother to bring it back. I did makeup effects on a movie that David Pryor produced but did not direct, called The Pack, which stands for Prefabricated Animalistic Cybernetic Killer.
Nice.
And it is not a good movie. It is entertainingly bad in some ways.
Mm-hmm.
But it stars Ted Pryor, his brother, and Sandel Bergman, who is, you know, she was Conan the Barbarian's love interest in the original Conan. She was in All That Jazz. She was the bad guy in Red Sonja. Like, she's an amazing actor. Mm-hmm. And it's like, this movie only exists on VHS. And they made it for nothing. They made it for like $60,000. Red West, who was in Roadhouse and stuff and was part of Elvis's actual posse. Like, all, you know, like all of this stuff. And it's like, that movie will only ever exist on VHS. There's no interest from anyone to remaster that film on anything else. Shot on 16mm. Who knows where the film is? Like, there's really no way to reclaim it. And, you know, to me, there's something kind of cool about having the physical media when you're kind of archiving it in a way, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's what I do. Anytime something comes out I really want to buy, like I get like the special edition Blu-ray, or I've been getting these badass special edition VHS releases from Wittern Entertainment, Broke Horror Fan. Yeah, have you heard about those?
No, I haven't. That's really cool.
Dude, because my favorite film is Mandy, and this is kind of what started the whole thing with the VHS stuff is I saw that Wittern Entertainment and Broke Horror Fan were doing like these special edition VHSs, big box editions, the big clamshell editions and stuff, like these newer movies. I'm like, dude, this is so fucking cool. So I got a ton of like new VHSs I don't even take out of their box because they're like art pieces for me. And yeah, I got those cool. Like sitting right next to me. And I just think it's a cool thing, like seeing the art that big, like that old school, that nostalgia feeling, you know?
Yeah, I love that. No, that's really great. I still have a VHS player for that very reason.
But oh, like, me too.
Yeah, I mean, well, obviously you do. I mean, to me, if you haven't seen that documentary, I highly recommend it, just because, there are these guys who are curating all these old VHS movies. And, like, there was one guy who, like, in his house had basically made an old school looking VHS video store.
Nice.
And it's so weird how quickly we just kind of shed an old technology. And look, you know, I get why we shed VHS. If, as a filmmaker, it's substandard picture quality. If picture quality is the most important thing to you, then VHS is, as a filmmaker, is not how you want people to see it. Like, I saw 2001: A Space Odyssey for the first time ever on VHS when I was a little kid, mm-hmm. And it's like years later I saw it at the Cinerama Dome in Hollywood. And I was like, and I mean, I had seen it since then on, you know, DVD and stuff. But like, until I saw it on the big screen, I'm like, I never understood this movie until I saw it on the big screen. Like, this is not a movie that's designed to be watched on a television. It just isn't.
Right. No difference.
Yeah. And, you know, most movies aren't that extreme. Like, you know, you can, I haven't seen the new Top Gun Maverick movie. I'm sure the theatrical experience is amazing. But when I see it on home video, I have a 4-year-old kid, so I have to really pick and choose what I go see in the theater. Mm-hmm. When I see it, you know, at home, it will be good. You know, there are movies like The Batman where I'm like, I want to go see that on the big screen, you know, partially just because, like, I could see the influences that went into the look of it just by looking at the trailer.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, that one looks like it's worth seeing it. And then, I saw Spider-Man No Way Home on an airplane on my phone. And it's like, I'm sure that I'm missing a lot of big nuances and big stuff, but I get it. Like, I know the movie now. But it varies from movie to movie. But, you know, but I think that you're obviously in the same camp, but it's like, there's something about VHS, about like putting the tape in and the low resolution of it.
Like, yeah, there's some magic to it, man. Like, you know, it hides a lot of the flaws, but I think that's a good thing. No, there's a lot of mystery behind it.
Yeah, it kind of puts it. Yeah, you're right. I mean, it's kind of what's interesting about it. And, you know, I mean, and also just the straight up nostalgia of it. You know, how many hours of my life, you know, as a kid did I spend watching movies on VHS, videotaping movies off of TV on VHS?
Yeah, the nostalgia is hard for that, like, especially with the 90s. Like, the 90s have been calling me back. Like, the 90s, I know they had some bad shit going on, but man, I missed the 90s. So I'm going to watch the whole 90s weekend. Like, I'm going to play fucking Sega games, and I'm going to go, you know, watch X-Files and all. I've been doing that, like, every, like, Saturday. Saturday night, I just kind of go 90s night, you know. I just play a bunch of, like, old Sega games, Super Nintendo games, and I go watch, like, something from the 90s or, you know, X-Files or Seinfeld, you know, just to bring that feeling again.
Yeah. I feel like it's in the nature of just being a person that, like, the stuff from your youth is the stuff that you remember, the stuff you love the most. And, you know, so it's like, I mean, I like, there's a lot of contemporary music and stuff that I like, but I do feel like, you know, there's, like, you know, like we, like I mentioned earlier, like Reanimator is such a comfort food movie for me to watch. To see something like that was, you know, I don't know, that has those kinds of elements that you probably couldn't do today. You probably you couldn't make Reanimator like that today.
Oh, no, definitely not. No, that's its own thing, and it would not be done today for sure.
Yeah.
But that keeps the magic, you know, like from that period has its own magic. So, you know, and now we have different kind of magic now, you know, it's just a lot of things we can't get away with. So.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and I mean, that's the big thing too, is like, you know, I'm old enough now that I've seen, like, you know, pop culture become nostalgia several times,
yeah.
You know, where it's like, where people are like, oh yeah, old school, blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, oh wait, I thought that was the new, oh crap. You know,
like, start playing your favorite songs on an oldie station. You're like, oh,
yeah.
That's an oldie
exactly.
Now.
I'll be like, oh yeah, I think of Yoshimi Battles the Pink Robots as the new Flaming Lips album, and it's actually almost 20 years old.
Wow, that's crazy. I remember when that came out.
me too. I remember buying it on CD and being very excited, and like that was the only thing in my car, you know, or Odelay by Beck, you know, like I remember being obsessed with that album, and you know, I mean, that album's almost 30 years old now.
Wow, that's like Korn too. Like, you know, those bands are all, that's 30 years old. That came out like 1998, 1999, like the first Korn album and stuff. And like, yeah. Oh, that's old and kind of retro-y, I guess. But it's weird, man. Time does fly.
Yeah, I mean, it does. And it, I mean, I remember the first time I was on a film set and the producer bragged to, it was the sound guy that I'd worked on Blair Witch. And he was like, I remember watching that movie when I was a kid. And I was like, you go fuck yourself. I was like, I wasn't that old when we made it. I was like 26. And and now it's like I can have a full conversation with a fully grown adult who was not alive when it came out. You know, somebody who was born the year it came out is now like 23.
Yeah, it's so
yeah, and you know, and so, you know, I mean, like it would be a little bit like, you know, Night of the Living Dead, which feels like, you know, it was just spit up whole by the earth, as far as I'm concerned. You know, that came out in 1968, so that was a few years before I was born. That's what somebody, when I was in my 20s, talking about Night of the Living Dead, that's what somebody talking about Blair Witch is like now in their early 20s. You know, I briefly met George Romero a couple of times, and I was like utterly starstruck. And, you know, I'm not putting myself on the same level as Ed and Dan in terms of, you know, I did not direct Blair Witch at all. But you know, like somebody who is a Blair Witch fan talking to me, who was in their early 20s, that's how removed it is from their experience.
Right. It's just crazy to think about, like, like how's it been that long, you know?
Yeah.
Hey, nuts. Well, Ben, it's been great talking with you, man. It's been a fucking killer podcast episode.
Oh, thanks. Thanks. Yeah. Hopefully, you'll like, Catchers when it comes out.
Oh, I'm looking forward to it. I'm going to put it on my list. So, before I let you go, is, like any way, like to stay in contact with you for like my listeners, like your Twitter, Facebook, anything like that, that they can follow you on?
I'm all over all of those things. The easiest way to find me is to go to my website, which is benrock.com. Pretty just the way it sounds. BENROCK.com. All my social media stuff is on there. I'm at Neptune Salad on Twitter. I am Benjamin_Rock on Instagram, because I guess I was asleep when I came up with my Instagram handle, and I didn't think Instagram would catch on. I'm on Facebook. You can find me. I have a stupid group on Facebook that you can join called Needs a Werewolf, where we pitch movie ideas, like, you know, I don't know, Murder on the Orient Express, but add a werewolf to it. But it's become more than that. Feel free to join me on there. But yeah, follow me on Twitter, Instagram. I'm not on TikTok. I think I'm too old for TikTok. I don't know.
Yes, same here. Not on that either.
I'm just not interested in TikTok. I know people older than me on TikTok. It's just not my thing. Anyway. But yeah, if you go to benrock.com, you can find even LinkedIn, go on there and network with me for work or whatever.
Killer, Ben. Well, I hope you have a great rest of your weekend, and, we will talk again soon.
All right. You too, man. Thank you for having me on. I really appreciate it. It was a lot of fun.
My pleasure. And take care, Ben.
You too.
Bye.